People who ride fixed gear bikes without brakes, a young musician who jumped to his death on his 21st birthday, racial integration in Stuyvesant Town, jazz clubs leaving the Bronx, people who explore subway tunnels and abandoned buildings. They're some of the subjects that were covered in the city section of the New York Times before it fell victim to cutbacks at the newspaper. Constance Rosenblum, who edited the section, has put together 50 essays from a variety of contributors under the title More New York Stories, the best of the city section of the New York Times. It's published by NYU Press, and I'm delighted that it brings her back to our show today, along with three of its contributors, John Freeman Gill, former reporter for the city section, Ben Gibbard, author of New York Waters, Profiles from the Edge, and later we'll be joined by Saki Naffo, who also wrote for the section. Welcome to our show, and in a couple of cases, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, Constance, this is the second collection?
Yes, we had a first collection that came out in 2005, and we loved it. I hope other people loved it. And so now there's a second collection, which is bittersweet because the city section folded 18 months ago.
Are there others that you might want to include in a third volume?
You know, I'd almost include everything we published. The hardest thing about doing the book is how many wonderful things there were and how many we had to leave out, sadly.
How long were you the editor of the city section?
I was the editor for 10 years.
And were all of these stories written under your watch?
Yes, they were.
Where did they come from? Were they assigned or did people just submit them?
It was a combination. I always have tons of ideas, more than anyone can ever do, and I throw them out and they're good, they're bad, they're indifferent. So I always had a bunch of ideas, and I really encouraged good writers like the ones we have on the show to come with us with ideas and not to second guess themselves. So we really tried to be a haven for things you might not see in other publications or other parts of the paper.
John Freeman Gill, you wrote perhaps the saddest piece in the book about a young composer named Noah Simring. How did you come to know his story?
Well, actually, that's an example of Connie having a special sense for what makes a good story. She actually read a postage stamp-sized paid obit and felt there was a story here because the parents in the obit mentioned that he had taken his life on his 21st birthday, and we felt that they were not ashamed and that they might be willing to talk about their situation.
Do you specialize in sad stories? You were on the show last May talking about the deascensioning of some pieces at the Brooklyn Museum, which was also rather sad.
Well, and I guess in some ways, as Connie said, this is bittersweet as well because we're talking about the dearly departed city section. But no, people who know me think I have a sense of humor, and I like to write fun things, silly things, and a lot of the stuff we did for the city section was about, they were really about idiosyncratic, lively characters that bring the city to life.
How much do we know of Noah Simring's story? Did he leave a note?
Well, what he left was, he was really quite an extraordinary artist. For a 21-year-old, he left behind an extraordinary amount of work. And specifically, he wrote very beautiful poetry. He didn't publish it, but he wrote very personal poetry, and that allowed me it was quite a gift to me as someone trying to tell his story, someone I never met. It allowed me to have him tell as much of his own story as possible by quoting his poetry.
And he also wrote music.
And he wrote quite a bit of music.
Did he put his poetry to music?
No. I think the poetry was a way of expressing himself. I mean, and the story I wrote is called In Noah's Room. And the story focuses on a series of vignettes that take place in his room where he recorded four albums, at least four albums, maybe six albums, with his best friend Aaron Bernstein.
And have these ever been released?
I don't know if they've actually been released. They were all fully, professionally published. It was a private thing. And in fact, a few days before they put the finishing touches on their final album, about 3 days before he took his own life, and the boy said to his best friend, Noah said to his best friend, when they were listening to the final album together, he said, this album is letting the world in. We're letting the world in now. So I had the sense that most of his life took place in that room, and that his life itself was kind of a cold room, and this was a way of letting people in.
He also was not doing what other people do. He preferred vinyl recording.
Yeah, he was a real traditionalist. He liked the sonic nuance of vinyl.
And you listened to his music. What was it like?
Well, it was varied, and I think it was very raw in a, and I mean that in the most positive way possible. That's what people who worked with him on albums said. Sometimes he had very mournful, intimate vocals. Sometimes there were thrashing, hard rock riffs. You know, a friend described it as going from a thunderstorm to a kiss, the very heavy stuff to the very mournful, intimate material.
We're talking about a new book called More New York Stories, the Best of the City section of the New York Times, which is published by NYU Press. And with us are two of the contributors to this collection, contributors to the city section. Later we'll be joined by a third. And they are John Freeman Gill and Ben Gibbard, later Saki Naffo. And also with us is Constance Rosenblum, who is the editor of the collection and was the editor of the city section for its last 10 years. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ben Gibbard, you accompanied some urban explorers in their wanderings. How did you come upon the story and how did you meet them?
It started off like a lot of stories that I did for the Times. I thought it wasn't going to be – I didn't realize the scope of it, the scale of it. And I found one guy who has an amazing website called Forgotten New York, and he's been walked through every street. He's been in every neighborhood. And I started talking to him, and as I did, the whole story sort of began to unfold. And I realized that there were dozens and dozens of hundreds, in fact, of people who were doing urban exploring that I had no idea about, including a beautiful young Asian woman who would strip off her clothes naked in the middle of the tunnel, which my wife didn't really want me doing, going with her.
She photographs herself nude.
She photographs herself
in some odd places.
She does. She had been she'd taken a great photograph, I think the one that appeared in the Times of the old abandoned Revere Sugar Factory in Red Hook in the Brooklyn waterfront.
Of course, a discreet photograph.
A discreet
in that case.
They were. They managed to get that past the legal
yes,
department.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Times,
when somehow. When Ben is talking, I remember the drama with the lawyers if we're all going to be, you know, arrested or fired for this picture. But happily, that didn't happen.
In the 50s and 60s, when if you ran a bathing suit ad, you had to airbrush out navels. So
exactly, yeah.
The Times, everybody's come a long way.
Yeah.
But We still have our rules on we do on radio as well, but she does it without a tripod or an assistant.
She sets up her own tripod and then sets it on a delay. And the photographs, I was suspicious at first because I thought maybe it was a gimmick. And I saw some of the pictures, and she described to me some of the circumstances in which she set them up, and I found them incredibly powerful because one of the things about this incredible infrastructure that's underneath our feet in the city is that it you feel when you see this naked form in it and you see her picture in it, and she'd taken these photographs around the world, there's this incredible sense of vulnerability and human vulnerability in these decaying structures around her, and I thought they were very powerful.
And what happens when somebody comes upon her doing this?
It did actually happen once. There was a homeless man who was living deep in a tunnel, one of the subway tunnels that was disused, and she had just taken off her clothes and had just set up the tripod and the camera, and this guy came back to his encampment where he was, and she was terrified for a moment, and then she decided she was just going to carry on with it, and she did. And this guy, I wonder what was going through his mind, but he just watched her do it and didn't cause any – there was no problems, and she took a photograph and left.
On her website, Miro Kim has a picture of her standing on the cables of a bridge, which is rather risky. What about going to some of the less welcoming streets of New York? Isn't there danger in some cases for strangers to show up?
I think there is a danger. In fact, NPR is doing a piece on Steve Duncan, who was one of the explorers that I did, and he takes amazing risks and goes to places that I would never be able to go to.
We did, and we had him on the show last week.
Yeah, he's in the
going underground,
going underground in sewer tunnels. He actually rappelled up the top of the World's Fair in Queens to the very top at night and took these beautiful
photographs. He just wanted to talk about that.
But the ones that I went to
that were may have been illegal. We don't want to talk about that.
They were essentially in terms of the mystery of these places. They were wonderful places. But in terms of their ease of access, I think because of who I was, they were fairly vanilla in terms of access. The only one dangerous one was climbing onto a rooftop. But the sense of beauty that was there was really, I think, what drives a lot of the urban explorers, a sense of being away from the rest of the city.
John, you were on staff.
To the extent that there's a staff at the city section, I was one of the regulars. Most of the section is typically written by five or six contributors, and then other writers fill in around that.
And now you're writing a novel?
I'm writing a novel set in 1970s Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Inspired by your work at the Times?
No, it actually has more to do. I think the sensibility is similar, but it's called The Gargoyle Hunters, and it's about set against actually the world. It's set in early 1970s, and it's set in the world of architectural salvage, much like what we talked about with Ivan Karp saving all those beautifully sculpted facade ornaments from buildings in the 70s.
That wound up at the Brooklyn Museum and now are kind of homeless.
That's right.
Well, Constance, one of the stories by Adam Ehrlich was about Jorge Munoz of Queens, who devotes all of his free time and much of his income to feeding the homeless, in this case, humans. How many men does he feed in a typical day?
Well, it's interesting you mention it because the number has gone up significantly since Adam wrote that story. And at the time, I think it was maybe 100 a day or less or more, depending. But since that article was published, there was a huge outpouring, I think more financial response to that than anything we did. And so much money was donated that a foundation was set up. So he's now able to feed literally hundreds of people a day, and it's really almost like a nonprofit business.
Yeah, but you do have to wonder what motivates somebody like that, I mean, to be that good.
Oh, yeah. And Jorge was clearly a remarkable young man. I think that Adam's story brought that out. And for someone of very limited means himself, he himself was an immigrant with a not very wonderful job. But his selflessness and humanity, he really had devoted his life to these men. It was really – it brought tears to your eyes.
Mostly Latin American day laborers?
Yes, yeah, and homeless. And this was often the one meal they had a day.
A piece by Cassie Feldman from 2007 is about homeless people who spend their time riding the buses between New York City and the casinos of Atlantic City.
Yes, and interestingly, you'd think this would be a terribly sad story, but the person she focused on really, in many ways, enjoyed his life much more than you would think, and he got pleasure out of his acquaintances at the casinos, and he, I think, felt himself quite special in that he had figured out a way to kind of beat homelessness, not 100%.
Well, people can make money without gambling.
Yes, yeah.
They just give you some money to go on the bus?
They give their incentives to get you down there on the theory that you get coupons and the theory that if you're down there, you'll gamble. But if you're clever and if you know what you're doing, you can kind of parlay all these incentives into your bus rides, your meals, and all the companionship.
Is that still happening, do you think?
Yes, I think it is.
My guests are Constance Rosenblum, who was the editor of the city section of the New York Times for 10 years. Are you still working at the Times?
I am. I'm writing a column for the real estate section called Habitats, and I like to think it's stories that could be published in the city section.
Well, we'll find out more about what happened to the city section as we continue our conversation. We're going to take a little break. We've been talking also with two of the contributors, John Freeman Gill, who's going to be leaving us. John, do you have any parting words?
That's what I hear. No, keep up the good work, Leonard.
And Ben Gibbard, who also contributed. We will be joined by Saki Nafu, who was also on the staff, if you can say anybody was on the staff of the city section. We'll be doing all of that right after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Constance Rosenblum, who was the editor for 10 years of the New York Times City section. And also with us are two contributors to a new book called More New York Stories, The Best of the City Section of the New York Times, published by NYU Press. Ben Gibbard has stayed here, and we are joined now by Saki Nafu, who contributed a piece about called Any Given Monday. You want to tell us about that, Saki?
Sure. The piece was about a basketball game that's been going on every Monday night in a little gym on the Upper West Side for the past 33 years. And my father played in the game for about 15 years. And the guy who started the game bugged me about joining for a long time. And finally, I tried it out and wrote a piece about it.
Now, it's guys get together every week and have a game. I mean, if you, in the case of basketball, it's five on each side. So did 10 people show up, or is a huge crowd?
It can be a big crowd sometimes. It depends. But, yeah, usually more than 10 people. There are a few different games each Monday night.
Uh-huh. And how did this thing get started?
It got started when Sandy Miller, who was one of the founders, he was playing a game at the Columbia Grammar and Prep School in the Upper West Side. And most of the people who played there were teachers. And eventually that game sort of fell apart, but he kept it going. And over the years, lots of other people joined from all over the city.
Well, it was 33 years old. So if somebody was 20 when it started, he'd or she'd only be 53. Are any of the original players still playing?
Quite a few of them are. There are players in their 60s and 70s.
And I'm assuming there are also some pretty young ones.
There's some younger ones too, yeah.
Do they have anything in common besides the love of playing basketball?
No.
And they cover every walk of life, I'm assuming.
Yeah, they come from all over the city. I mean, the game is kind of like a microcosm of the city itself. In the story I list, some of the different people have played there. And so the mime, who was outside of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the 80s, played there for a while. Macaulay Culkin played there. A Haitian refugee played there. So really every type of person.
What about skills?
Skills are...
Because there are some games, like the games in Greenwich Village, where you're just laughed off the court if you're not a really good player.
Right. No, it's not like that. It's a pretty slow game, but I'd say most guys have about one or two moves. But sometimes they're pretty good at those one or two moves. So.
Constance, several of the pieces in the book are about the joys of Brooklyn, which has become the hip place over the past couple of decades. In 2006, Sarah Grand lamented that everything in Brooklyn had already been written about. Is that because... so many writers live in Brooklyn?
I think it's because so many writers do live in Brooklyn. And in fact, one of the pieces in the collection by Sakitu Mehta on Brooklyn and its evolution, another writer who lives in Brooklyn, he wrote it because I was so overwhelmed by all the story ideas from Brooklyn, and I thought a smart way to get on top of them would be for us to do a special issue on Brooklyn, past, present, and future. And Sakitu's essay on what Brooklyn meant to him and to Brooklyn versus India was the lead essay. And I realized at one point I could have filled the entire section week after week, year after year, with articles about Brooklyn by Brooklyn writers.
Because we're so proud of it.
Because and Brooklyn is so great. I live in Brooklyn. But I didn't also want to do that. As you know, I have a great fondness for the Bronx, having written a book about the Grand Concourse and Queens, you know, world's most diverse borough, and Staten Island, the ignored borough. And I really wanted to have us cover all our bases.
Are you saying ignored in general or ignored after major snowstorms?
That's a question for a politician.
You said that you could have had a whole section just devoted to Brooklyn. You could have also, based on the stories in this book, had a lot on the homeless. That is something that that recurs again and again because New York has such a serious homeless problem.
That's it. And also, you know, as much as I wanted the stories in the section to be lovely and fun and delightful and sometimes upbeat, I also believe in journalism as the world in which you afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I wanted us not to be the section that only writes about yuppies and hipsters and cool people with great apartments and cool jobs. And there's so many needy people in the city, and I wanted our section to reflect their lives.
And not just the living. Emily Brady wrote a piece about Potter's Field on Hart Island.
And the nameless dead, I think that is typical of things we like to do also because I think the shadow of the past hangs over the city very powerfully. That's why people love the old buildings and love the old stories. It's as if the past is really present, I think, for many people.
But the Potter's Field isn't open to the public, and you can't go and mourn a lost loved one.
They're under very special conditions. You can do a little bit, but at the time she wrote the story, which was a few years ago, the laws were very restrictive.
And then a man named Lou Haggins was a homeless man whose friends wanted to mourn him.
Yes, yes.
There's an organization called Picture of the Homeless.
Yes, and they were very instrumental in trying to bring attention to the fact that if you were unnamed and buried in Potter's Field, you could not be visited by those who knew you.
Now, could that story just as easily have been written by you, Saki, or you, Ben? Or would you have, if Constance had suggested a story like that, would you have said, well, that's not really me. I'd rather do something else.
Well, it happens that I worked at an SRO with formerly homeless people for 3 years, and I actually am one of the people who wrote about the homeless for the city section. I wrote a piece about my time there at the SRO. So, I would have jumped right on that.
Ben, did you feel like you specialized?
I think after a while I did come to specialize, I guess, more in profiles of people. The first story that I did on spec that I just sent in randomly to Connie was a profile of my mailman who'd done the same Brooklyn beat for about 25 years and had seen the neighborhood change. And to my amazement, Connie said she would take it. And it's sort of from there I ended up doing profiles. I think that's one of the great things about Connie as an editor, is that she really understood the particular interests and skills of each of the writers and turned the stories towards that.
I'm going to invite our listeners to send in some things, some comments on stories that they feel that the New York Times has missed over the years, because there are still lots of New York stories. If there were still a city section, it probably would be easier to get them in. But you can call us here or you can write us. Go to our show page at WNYC.org and write in your comment. Or you can call us at 646-829-3985. As I remember it, Connie, the city section was created because readers felt that the Times was more likely to cover a story in Westchester or Nassau County than in the Bronx or Queens.
Exactly. It was considered the hole in the donut. It was the time when the Times had regional sections for New Jersey, Connecticut, Westchester, Long Island, and no section that specifically focused on the five boroughs. And in the early 90s, it was decided that that section would be created and was called the city. And in the beginning, it was very servicey because it was really such a hard time for the city, how to fix up your local park, that sort of thing. But as the city became in better shape, its focus changed, became more literary, and it became a different New York in many respects.
Was the section killed just to save money?
Yeah. If there were multiple New York-themed sections in at that point. There were four separate regional sections. There was the New York section, and then there was us. And we were freelance, and even though we didn't pay very much, it was extra money. And it was at the time when the paper was making a lot of economical choices and hard choices.
So what do you think of the current approach, including local stories in the main news section? I know you still work for the Times.
I think I've made the Times live and be well, and the more New York stories, the better.
But it does feel kind of at times like shoehorned into a part of the newspaper where it really doesn't belong. And there is still the Weekend Metropolitan section, which I guess has become the place to tell many of these stories.
Exactly, yes.
Do you miss writing these kinds of things, or can you still write them? Saki?
Oh, I miss writing them. I'm doing more magazine stories now, but I still walk around the city sometimes and think that would make a great city section story.
The Laura Shane Cunningham writes about adopting a baby starling. How did that bird come into her life?
Under very strange circumstances, it kind of fell off a drain pipe one night, and I think she would have been happy had the bird died and not been part of her life, but her daughter rescued it and fell in love with it. And Laura could not let it go and she fell in love with a bird also.
And Jocko Wayland wrote a story about fixed gear bikes without brakes. I find it hard enough just to ride a bike.
Well, I found it terrifying to edit that story, and I kept kind of seeing myself go head over heels onto the pavement and dying. But he insisted they were safer than you would think, and they're incredibly trendy, and it was a very popular story.
And people, racers use those bikes, don't they?
They
can't apply brakes?
But they ride them nonetheless.
One of the pieces written by somebody who used to work for us here, Jennifer Gilmore, who mostly writes fiction these days, is when somebody specializes in fiction and then writes a journalistic piece, can you spot that right away?
Well, the wonderful thing about the section is we were able to use fiction writers using novelistic techniques to write essays, to write long-form journalism. I think anyone who's a writer of fiction is certainly someone who considers their words very carefully.
Let's take a call. David Kirby from Brooklyn, how you're on the air.
Hey, Leonard.
Hey, David. Kirby. Yeah, but you wrote for the Times, didn't you?
I've been on your show a couple times, and I wrote for the City section from 97 till about 2003. Connie came in towards the end of my tenure there. How are you doing, Connie?
Hi, nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. I live in Brooklyn, too, of course.
Of course.
just when you asked about things that didn't get covered, this was before Connie came on board there, but I did a cover story in about June of 2001 on the Coast Guard and how they were revamping operations and starting to really, get new equipment. And it was a really interesting story, and I was reporting on all their anti-terrorism efforts that they were getting underway. There was going to be a big celebration in the harbor, and I wrote paragraphs and paragraphs about all their anti-terrorism efforts that they were launching. And my editor said to me, "Oh, David, nobody wants to read about terrorism." And that was in the summer of 2001.
Oh, my gosh.
That's one thing that probably should have been covered.
You have another one before I move on to another call?
Yes. I wrote wonderful stories, and I enjoyed it so much. It was a great launch. But this story I covered at a seminar at the Waldorf Astoria. A guy was a dog trainer, and he said how to get your dog to go to the bathroom outside. He said, "I will bet you $50 a poop that this will work." And so I put that quote in the story. My editor said, "David, this is a family paper. We can't use that word." And she emailed her editor and went up the chain and up the chain all the way to Lilyveld. And it came back down, and the response was, "Poop okay, just this once."
That was before my time.
Yeah, now I think that this would not make the public editor's section in the Sunday Times. Yeah. We've moved on. Thank you.
I wish it was still around.
Thank you.
David, thank you so much for calling us. Since David got to tell two stories, Ben, you have another one that you really love doing that didn't make it into this book?
You should tell about the guy who wrote the Empire State Building.
The writer.
The writer. Yeah, he was great.
This was one of Connie's ideas. I'd actually never heard of him. He's a writer called Arthur Nersesian. And he was made famous. His first book was a book that I probably can't say on NPR. Or print the name in the Times, but he was one of the last of the real bohemian writers. He lived in a terrible apartment in the East Village where I think he'd been for 30 years. He was broke constantly the whole time, and he was writing a stream of books, and the last five of which I think were a tetracycle or whatever it's called about the life of Robert Moses. Hmm. And he was obsessed with Robert Moses, and he'd taken the power broker.
He was sort of the anti-Robert Caro.
He was the anti-Robert Caro.
He loved Robert Moses.
He loved Robert Moses. He had a sort of love-hate, but I think it probably tended more towards the love end of the spectrum. And he'd taken Caro's great book on Moses, The Power Broker, and had split it up into three digestible chunks, which he carried around with him, and he read everywhere on the subway. And that was a real find. He was a wonderful, wonderful man, and it was a great, fun story to do.
Chris from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Well, I had an incident happen to me, actually to my brother recently, that I thought would have been great. And we tried to see in the Times and no longer had the City section. But my brother had cancer, and he recently was recruited for a special program to see radiation versus PET scan. In any case, he was irradiated. They injected him with something. And he was on the subway, a packed subway during rush hour, and he was changing at 59th and Lex, which is a pretty busy station. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the police were converging all over. They were clearing the station. There was panic. And it was because they had a radiation detector. And the two things that came to mind was, I mean, other people must have, you know, radiation coming from Mount Sinai. And second, how did just an average policeman, how was he able to even detect this? And then they cleared this station so quickly, and thank God he had his papers.
We have run out of time, but this does sound like a story that should be in the newspaper.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for calling us. I don't know. Who does he write to?
The Metropolitan Section, maybe.
And my great thanks to Constance Rosenblum, who was the editor of the City Section for quite a while, and to the three writers who have joined us, who contributed to a new book called More New York Stories, which is published by NYU Press, Ben Gibbard, John Freeman Gill, and Saki Naffo.